This is the last in a series entitled A Wild Scene in Theology, Current Theological and Ethical Trends. It's a time of great ferment in theological studies and many new voices. The ferment and the new voices are both grassroots and in circles of professional scholarship. The survey that I've tried to do this week has been of necessity a modest one. It's very difficult for me to wrap my mind around that, but it's been fun trying. And for the last session today on a Jewish Jesus and new creation, sort of, I want to look at the ferment in studies and in dialogues which focus on this most important figure of all for us, Jesus from Nazareth in the region of Galilee. I need to recall two things from yesterday when we talked a bit about the Bible and the revival of the Bible. Those two things are that we can now distinguish New Testament materials along these lines. One can make a distinction, one can trace, one can sort materials which refer to and come directly out of and have their context in Jesus, the historical figure Jesus, and the Jesus movement, that is, those people who are contemporary with Jesus and a part of that. We can sort the materials in the New Testament that have their setting and their origin there from materials which have to do with the early church communities of the New Testament in the decades following Jesus. None of the New Testament documents were written at the time of Jesus himself. The earliest written documents come from about 60, and then it goes onward to about 120. And you have documents that reflect the early church's use of the Jesus materials, first among Jewish Christians, and the first Christians were Jews, and then among Gentile Christians. In the Jesus movement, you had very few, if any, Gentiles. It all took place in Palestine, and in cities where there were very few Gentiles. You may have been some, and there are some reflections of that. Later on, many of the documents are efforts to preach the gospel to almost strictly Gentile audiences. So we can make those distinctions. That's helpful. There's another set of distinctions that's helpful and important. We can, in the New Testament materials, distinguish between pre-resurrection collections and materials and post-resurrection collections and materials. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time with the Sermon on the Mount and a reading of it from a Jewish point of view. And that's an example of materials that go back to a common source that Matthew and Luke used. It's called the Q source. And it is a collection of teachings which originates very close in its formulation to the teachings of Jesus himself. And it comes out different. In Matthew, it's a Sermon on the Mount. In Luke, it's a Sermon on the Plain. So it sort of just depends on your altitude there. But they share a common source that goes very close to Jesus. So those distinctions between Jesus and Jesus movement and the early church uses of those materials, and then the distinctions within the Jesus movement between pre-resurrection and post-resurrection are important and helpful. Now, let me say a couple of things about a recent expanded interest in Jesus as the historical figure and the new ferment that is present in familiar quarters. Again, this is both reflective of grassroots movements and reflective of circles of professional scholarship. First, the expanded interest, the interest in Jesus in quarters that have not shown such interest before. One is just a general interest in the culture in Jesus. Now it's not uncommon to pick up a secular magazine. I didn't get along my copy of Atlantic magazine, but there on the cover is Jesus and a long article talking about the new ferment around Jesus. Well, Atlantic magazine, or pick any others, would not have done that a decade ago. I picked up New York Times Book Review, and in addition to a book reviewing Marilyn Monroe, there is on the front page Jesus among the historians. Well, the New York Times a decade ago wouldn't have had as a front page review a survey of new interests, scholarly and popularly, about Jesus. There's a new cultural awareness and interest. Jaroslav Pelikan, a Lutheran theologian at Yale, writes a book entitled Jesus Through the Centuries. It is an immediate bestseller. It went to paperback right away. I put it up here and I strongly recommend it. It's a book which talks about the different understandings of Jesus Christ in different places through the centuries. It doesn't focus on this scholarship of the Jewish Jesus that we're going to, but it is indicative of the expanded and recent interest in Jesus. Another example, the peace movement in Europe. For the first time in quite some time, the German theological seminaries don't have the foggiest notion, and the German churches don't have the foggiest notion what to do with all these students studying for the ministry. They're bursting at the seams. Now, this is a country where people don't go to church. 3%, 3%, 4%, 5%. Where did these young people come from, and why are they showing up in theological faculties of the seminary? And it's a crisis for the German church. There aren't jobs for them, because there aren't that many parishes that can support that many students that interested. Where did they come from? They came out of the peace movement. And in the peace movement, those religious dimensions of the peace movement came to have a kind of focus in the Sermon on the Mount. And you had this testimony of young Germans saying, we're not churchgoers, but we're drawn to Jesus, and we want to know more. And I'll explain a little bit later when we get to Pinchas Lapid, who is an Orthodox Jew. I'll let you know how this book came about. It also came out of the peace movement in Germany. So those are just some indications of expanded interest in Jesus in different cultural settings. Now, in addition, there is an expanded interest in Jesus in the dialogue that is increasing among world religions. We're going to focus on Jewish-Christian interest in Jesus, but that's not the only quarter. In Christian-Islam conversations now, there is lots of interest in Jesus. That's in part because in the Quran, Jesus is a major figure. He's a great prophet of God, as is Moses in the Quran. Some of the most beautiful passages about Mary are in the Quran. If you didn't know that, you ought to. And the Holy Family, now it's not the Holy Family of Islam, but the Christian Holy Family of Mary, Joseph, and Jesus has a place of reverence and significance in the Quran. So Jesus becomes one of the places where Christians and Muslims can talk with one another, and that's difficult, as you can well imagine, these days. But Jesus becomes a focal point because they both hold Jesus with reference. in reverence. In Hinduism, too, you have an appreciation of Jesus as a great spiritual figure. And Jesus becomes a point where the dialogue between Christians and Hindus can happen. Now, part of that is in among scholars, but part of that's a spillover of the influence of such as Gandhi, for whom Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount were deeply important. Gandhi said more than once that his campaign was based on largely on the Sermon on the Mount, and that what endeared Jesus to him so was the Sermon on the Mount. And he had a picture of Jesus where he lived. So the second area then of interest in Jesus is the dialogue in world religions. And I'm just going to draw three quick conclusions before we focus on the Jewish Jesus. One is that I think Jesus is the best thing going ecumenically. If you mean by ecumenical, the genuine meaning of that word, namely the whole inhabited world. Jesus is the place where we can talk, and about whom we can talk. From Christians to all sorts of other quarters, whether of other religions or of just general interest in this figure by people who are not observant in religious communities. Secondly, there is a new willingness to talk about this key figure where the stakes are so high. In Jewish-Christian dialogue, for example, there's been conversations between Jews and Christians, and there's been cooperation, National Conference of Christians and Jews. Most of that has been polite. That is to say, you look at the areas where you can cooperate, where it doesn't get down to basic faith claims clashing with one another. Now there's a new willingness to talk about those points of great, where the faith claim stakes are high. And there's a willingness to talk about Jesus in this context, a key figure where the stakes are high, but a new willingness to talk about it. And then the third conclusion is that there is so much ferment around Jesus, and that has, in one sense, always been true, that one must conclude that there is something about Jesus with which we will never be done. And I just want to quote the last three or four sentences of this review in the New York Times book review. After all of this survey of Jesus among the scholars, what is beyond dispute is that Jesus of Nazareth is one of those perennial questions in history with which humankind is never quite done. In a ministry of 2 or 3 years, he attracted and infuriated his contemporaries, mesmerized and alienated the ancient world, unleashed a movement that has done the same ever since, and so changed the course of history forever. There will continue to be ferment around Jesus. We will not be done with Jesus, and we will, in a sense, always come to this question of who is this mesmerizing figure who changed the course of history forever. Well, certainly recent scholarship and recent movements have underscored that. All right, before actually going to look at some of the discussions about the Jesus the Jew, let me just ask you whether in quarters in which you travel or quarters about which you know there is new or heightened interest in Jesus. I mean, surely this isn't everywhere, so I'd like to know whether that's been the experience. Yeah?
I know, in our Jews for Jesus has become a reasonably active organization.
Mm.
We had a speak at Passover last year.
Mm-hmm.
About Passover celebration, and talk.
Uh-huh.
And they're doing that frequently. They've become quite well known throughout the area.
And when you say for the Seder, you mean for Passover?
Mm-hmm.
So in the churches, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So they've been in the churches in your area?
Right.
Yeah. Good. Other?
There.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sometimes
I was going to say that I have some friends that are really into the New Age movement, and there seems to be a lot of interest among the New Ages of looking at the story of Jesus.
Yeah, I'm not much familiar with the movement, but that wouldn't surprise me,
yeah.
You know, from what I do know. Probably other figures as well. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Jesus among them. Any other things that jump to mind? If they don't jump to mind, then it's probably not of marked significance. But I'll mention one more sort of indication of general interest that Paul Hansen, well, the Hansons and we were staying together in Chalet 11, and Paul had just gotten a big batch of mail that had been forwarded, and I was looking through the bulletin for Harvard Divinity School and just checking the offerings, and I saw a course there offered by Harvey Cox that was entitled Jesus and the Moral Life, and I asked Paul, does Cox get any students for that course? And it's the second largest enrolled course in Harvard University.
Wow.
He has between 500 and 700 students sign up each year for a course entitled Jesus and the Moral Life. Few of whom would go to church. This is not the divinity school. This is in the university. It's amazing. Okay, well, let's go on to focus a bit on the Jewish Jesus, or Jesus the Jew. Obviously, we cannot survey the whole scene of ferment around Jesus, so we can focus on this as one slice or one aspect of that scene. And what I want to do rather briefly is look at Jesus the Jew from both the perspective of Jewish scholars and from the perspective of Christian scholars. A note in passing, when Pelikan begins his survey of Jesus through the centuries, he begins with Jesus the rabbi, Jesus the teacher, Jesus the prophet, Jesus the messianic figure. He begins with those things which are most closely identified with Jesus the Jew. Incidentally, when he ends that and brings it up to the present and wants to sort of say what his own understanding of Jesus is, the name he gives is Jesus, the man for the world. That's some indication of this spread of the impact of this one who changed history forever. There is more and more interest in Jesus the Jew, and the attention, I think it's correct to say, is focused less on those questions which were so important in like the 3rd and 4th century and which established so much of Christian doctrine. I mean questions like, how is Jesus both human and divine? Questions of the two natures. There's less attention to a question like that. Those were the questions, the ones that gave us the great creeds. The Trinity, that is, how did Jesus relate to God the Father and to the Holy Spirit? Those were questions which were the agenda of the classical culture, the Greco-Roman thought world, and they had to be addressed when the gospel penetrated those quarters. Now, if you look back at Jesus the Jew and the Jesus movement, it's not those questions which get the attention. It is questions like, what is the relationship of Jesus to God and the kingdom or reign of God that Jesus is proclaiming. We'll get into some of those questions in a little more detail in a minute. There's more and more interest, in other words, in Jesus as a Jewish messianic figure, a prophet of God. There is a hesitation to rush too quickly to the questions which arose out of the Gentile world, namely questions such as, what about the pre-existence of Jesus? Or what about Jesus' status at the right hand of God? Or what about Jesus as Christ, which is the Greek word, the anointed one, for Messiah? But it's a question, does it translate when you go from the Jewish Jesus into a Greek world? It's those questions about the Jewishness of Jesus that we must stay with for a while and not run too quickly to the great claims that came out of speaking the gospel to another culture from the one in which it originated. So there's a deep interest and a deep identification with Jesus as the one utterly devoted to God and embodying in his own life, death, ministry, and resurrection the very character of God. Martin Buber, one of the great Jewish philosophers, calls Jesus the central Jew because of this embodiment of the very way of God in his own life and his utter singular devotion to God. So this faithful, extraordinary Jew then becomes the focus of attention, not just for the Jews, observant Jews interested in Jesus, but for Christians looking at that as well. Juan Segundo is a liberation theologian from Latin America, from Uruguay. When he was asked by someone in an interview, what is liberation theology all about anyway? Segundo answered, it is our effort to get back into the proximity of Jesus of Nazareth, where Christians first began to do theology, and to start over again from there. There's a book by Segundo called The Historical Jesus, and it tries to unpack that. Now, since we can make these distinctions in these materials, it tries to unpack the story, reading it from the front side. And it's very interesting because Segundo gets very polemical against later understandings of Jesus. And so one chapter is entitled Anti-Christology? Question mark. That is this liberation theologian's effort to look at the Jew, Jesus the Jew and his story ending up undermining later understandings that have been held about Jesus? So is it anti-Christology? Christology meaning understanding of Christ. And then the next chapter is entitled, and you can hear his polemics, Jesus in the Grip of Theology. But there is this effort by Christian theologians as well as Jewish ones in trying to get into the proximity of Jesus of Nazareth, where Christians first began to do theology and start again from there. Now, in view of the time, and I'm sure this is a subject for discussion, I'm going to skip over to some questions asked by another Christian New Testament scholar, Walter Wink. I put the title of a book up there, Violence and Nonviolence in South Africa, Jesus' Third Way, a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, and reading South Africa today in light of the possibilities of Jesus' Third Way. But Walter Wink asks questions like this. I want you to listen very carefully to these questions. They're the kind of questions we can ask now of the documents because of the distinctions that we can make among in the New Testament materials themselves. They're not the kinds of questions that Christians have usually asked about Jesus. How did Jesus live out his own sense of calling in his own life? Before he was worshipped as God incarnate, how did Jesus struggle to incarnate God? No Jew would say, "I am God." Christians later said that of Jesus. Wink says, now let's ask first, before jumping to that, before he was worshipped as God incarnate, how did Jesus, the Jew, struggle to incarnate God, embody the way of God in his own life? Before he became identified as the source of all healing, he identified as the source of all healing, how did he relate to and teach his disciples to relate to the healing source, capital S? How did he teach them to relate to God? Before forgiveness became a function solely of his cross, how did he understand people to be forgiven? We turn to Jesus for forgiveness. How did Jesus understand people to be forgiven? What did he instruct his disciples about forgiveness? Anyway, that's there in the New Testament, but it's coming at the figure differently from later Christian claims. Before he became identified as Messiah, how did he relate to the profound meaning in the messianic image? We know from those New Testament sources that Jesus is very, very reticent to take up that title, to let people call him Messiah. So before he became identified as Messiah, how did he relate to that messianic image? It's rich, of course, in Judaism, and it's rich in the legacy for Jesus. So we have a really mind-boggling possibility, and this is what has created such ferment. That mind-boggling possibility is Jesus before Christianity, and a chance to see Jesus before Christianity. We have to always remember Jesus was a Jew, but Jesus was not a Christian. Or to put it a little bit differently, as Lapide does here, for me, Pincus Lapide is an Orthodox Jew. For me, Jesus is less the founder of Christianity than the instigator of a Christian way of life that has its great manifesto in the Sermon on the Mount. A Christian way of life that at bottom amounts to a Jewish way of life. And like it, unfortunately, finds far too few imitators in either community of faith. And I too remind you that behind both what is now normative Judaism, namely rabbinic Judaism, and Christianity, you have biblical Judaism. That is, what we have as normative Judaism today is one of those great religious traditions born at the same time and out of the same milieu as is Christianity, which began also among Jews. You have twin-born, then, these two great movements. And Lapide is reflecting some of that when he says, I don't think of Jesus so much as founder of Christianity as a Christian way of life that is at bottom also a Jewish way of life, and too few imitators in either camp.
Could you say again what the twin born?
Yeah.
Christianity is born out of Judaism around the figure Jesus. At the same time, you have the birth of rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism of the rabbis. The Pharisees are the most important single party here. The rabbinic Judaism and Christianity, neither one is identical with the Judaism of the Hebrew Bible. You don't, okay? I mean, that's sort of a standard way of looking at it among both Jews and Christians, scholars. Now, let's see.
Doesn't rabbinic Judaism go back 500 years prior?
But it's
the Babylonian Exodus.
Yeah, that's when you have the first rabbis and synagogues. That's born because the temple is destroyed, right, etc. But the you need to correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mike. But my understanding from is that what then became the prominent form of Judaism.
Hillel and Shammai,
yeah,
who operated at the time of Jesus.
Of Jesus, their contemporaries.
That they added a richness of interpretation of the oral law.
Yeah.
And their predecessors, my history is poor to come up with names top of my head, but the oral law goes back to, in strength, to the Babylonian exile time. When,
yes,
back in 586, when the Jews, yeah, had this, packed up their knapsacks and headed off to Babylon,
yeah,
I guess Woody Allen's terminology.
Yeah. They lost temple, they lost land, they lost kingship.
Right.
They had to start over.
And in that time, the only thing that the Jews had left to deal with was to maintain.
I'm wondering exactly how to. Let me pick up just a couple of more points about looking at Jesus from a Jewish point of view, and then go to Lapid, so we've got a little time for discussion. Let me just mention some works first. Pinchas Lapid, the Sermon on the Mount, is by an Orthodox Jew. We'll get into that. The thing that I want to note at this point is that other works by Christian scholars now converge with that reading. And it's not just because they heard Lapid and said, aha, that's right. It's because of the maturation of biblical scholarship, knowing more and more that is coming to a common focus. E.P. Sanders is a Christian New Testament scholar, has written a book called Jesus and Judaism. Not easy reading, but it has already been regarded by some as kind of the work of the decade in this area, because it shows how much of the detail of what Jesus is talking about is so thoroughly rooted and has its meaning in Judaism. Galia Kornfeld is a Jewish scholar and has edited a volume of collected essays, all by Jewish scholars, entitled The Historical Jesus. The interest is not only in Second Temple Judaism, as Mike said, from a few centuries before Jesus till the destruction of the temple, that is from 520 BCE to 70 years after Jesus, but it's not just Second Temple Judaism, and thus you get into a little bit about Jesus. It's Jesus as a figure of interest himself. Okay, maybe I'll come back to some of that after looking at Lapid for a moment, because I don't want to lose discussion time. I'll just take a quick view of Lapid. This book originated out of the peace movement in Germany. Pinchas Lapid himself was a Jew who fought with the British regiment against Nazi Germany during the Second World War, and then went to live in Israel for a while, and then returned to Germany, from which he had been he had emigrated to Great Britain, and has been active in trying to promote Jewish-Christian dialogue between German Christians and Judaism. in the course of that, he has done work in New Testament as well as in Hebrew Bible. Wrote a book on the resurrection. He and a German Christian scholar, Jürgen Moltmann, wrote a book together on Jewish-Christian issues. Then he wrote an essay published in a magazine in Germany. The essay was entitled, What Did Jesus Ask? And it was an essay interpreting the Sermon on the Mount from a Jewish point of view, looking at those verses, asking what do these words mean, where do they have their history, what is Jesus calling up, and to whom is it written, and what is he getting after. That essay received such wide spread circulation in Germany that Pinchas Lapie was asked not only to write a book-length manuscript on the Sermon on the Mount, but the peace movement had been so taken with Jesus that the television in Germany asked for a debate between Pinchas Lapide, representing Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, and Hans Appel, the defense minister of the Republic, Federal Republic of Germany. And the question was, is the Sermon on the Mount a program for peace, or is it a unrealizable utopia? And the subtitle of the book is Utopia or Program for Action, Sermon on the Mount. Now, he starts out...
Is that in the bookstore?
This was in the bookstore the last I checked. They had some copies. But I'm not pushing the book so much. I think it's a good book. I'm not pushing the book so much as I'm using it to just illustrate a new look at things when you look at Jesus as a Jew. And so he begins the book by citing 8 misinterpretations of the Sermon on the Mount. And if these don't cover most of Christian history, I'm not sort of surprised. You see if you identify with any of these. Have you heard these anywhere before? The first might be called the perfectionist conception. It sees the Sermon on the Mount as a list of super commandments announcing loudly and clearly, this is what you must do to be blessed. Beatitude does not come any cheaper. Such a view reflects an exaggerated legalism, which Paul and Luther would reject as gross heresy. Worse, it is a textbook example of the infamous works justification theory, which holds that salvation can be earned by deeds and tries to build its own ladder to heaven. The Sermon on the Mount is Mosissimus Moses, to use Luther's phrase. That is the epitome of inflexible legalism. Mosissimus Moses. More papist than the Pope, more Mosaic than Moses, and to indicate legalism, a perfectionism called for and demanded but not possible. The second misconception is the theory of unrealizability, based on the idea that all these demands are really superhuman. Their sole purpose is to drum into human beings their own inadequacies, to drive you to Christ. Ask for grace, because you can't beat the Sermon on the Mount. According to this interpretation, the Sermon on the Mount is inflicted on them to make them stumble. At that point, convinced of their need of redemption and deeply contrite, they will be prepared to hear God's word of merciful forgiveness. In the words of Gerhard Kittel, German theologian, the meaning of the Sermon on the Mount is demolish. It can only tear down. In the long run, it has only one purpose, to expose and exhibit the great poverty in empiric human beings. To put it another way, he goes on, this is what you ought to do, you wretched weakling, but you can't succeed, you know full well. That is why you need God's gracious love for everything you undertake. Third theory, invoking interim ethics refers to the fact that in some interpretations, Jesus expected the end of the world very, very soon. And this is an ethic for the last days, but not, it wouldn't be one for the long haul. If you had time on your hands, this is you'd have a different matter. A third theory invoking interim ethics can be described as last-minute panic. It sees the Sermon on the Mount as a summons to one final exertion before the imminent catastrophe of the Last Judgment. Now pull yourself together one last time, you poor devil, before it's too late. This is what is written between the lines. For even tomorrow the days of divine grace may come to an end. But the fact that Jesus erred in his intense expectation of the immediate passing of the world and the advent of the reign of heaven as a completely new beginning threatens to rob this apocalyptic interpretation of relevance for today. That has been an interpretation. A fourth explanation compares the imperatives of the Sermon on the Mount with the sober realpolitik, or politics of realism, of the past 4,000 years of world history, and with an audible sigh of relief, concludes that it rests on moral reverie that can confidently be written off as utopian. Utopia here is used in the literal sense, something without a place, not of this world, homeless on our earth, and of no consequences for practical politics. Some have said the Sermon on the Mount is not about practical politics. Can't be, it's utopian. Fifth interpretation asserts the Sermon on the Mount holds only for the narrow circle of Jesus' disciples, calls only them to emulate him. I'll go quickly, but that's how it developed in monasticism. The laity wasn't bound by the Sermon on the Mount if you took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Those were the evangelical councils. Where did they come from? Sermon on the Mount. It's to maintain this stream. But you didn't expect everyone to be able to do that.
The variation of the vow was to be perfect.
Yeah. And some ought to give themselves fully to that vocation. The sixth approach rests on the romantic radicalism that is determined to bypass the complexity of life with a few simple but splendid claims. The Sermon on the Mount is elevated to a timeless, universally valid manual of ethics for humanity, demanding everything, but at bottom imposing nothing. There are high moral calls in a complex world, and we shouldn't lose them, but they're not. They don't really address the complexity of life. A seventh explanation sees here a pointer toward a correct attitude in the private sphere as an aid to a correct relationship with God. Looked at from this perspective, the Sermon on the Mount presents an especially fine super-ethic, an end in itself for self-centered perfection, society being merely a tool for individual redemption. That is, you focus on your individual relationship to God, but it's not for social affairs. It's an interior matter and an individual matter. And then, finally, an eighth reading is offered by the historian who, aware of the historical circumstances of a small subjugated Jewish state, squeezed to the very brink of extinction between Roman brutality and zealot violence, soberly deduces from the Sermon on the Mount a positive practical program. Here are the peace tactics, wise as a serpent, gentle as a dove, of a worldly wise person, a strategist who repudiates both hopeless war against the Roman superpower and faint-hearted desertion of the cause in favor of liberating his people from the Roman yoke through nonviolent resistance. And Lapide himself is going on with a modification of that last one. He is going to say Jesus is talking to a certain group of Jews, especially the powerless, and offering them a way which is like unto God's way. And it is a practical, doable program. Lapide says Jesus as a Jew is utterly serious about two things. One, an utter devotion to God and the power of God, and two, a realistic student of human nature, and the Sermon on the Mount is a way to address both. Well, Wink says much the same thing about the Sermon on the Mount, and it represents this convergence. Now, I'm looking at the time, and I think we better turn this into question and comment, your comments, your questions, rather than me going to choose more specific examples. I mostly want to open up an awareness of the interest, and secondly, just consider looking at Jesus as a Jew. So let's just find out what people have in mind to ask about or to pursue, not necessarily Sermon on the Mount.
Many years ago, Christopher Stendahl wrote an article on the Sermon on the Mount in which he lists a lot of those same options and dispels them. And I'm interested in the difference between where he ends up and where Lapide ends up, because Lapide, you say, ends up saying the Sermon on the Mount is a practical way for us to do things.
Yeah.
Stendahl's conclusion is that the Sermon on the Mount isn't practical at all, but through our faith we're free to live in that impractical way.
So
his name for that way of looking at the Sermon on the Mount, he calls messianic license.
Uh-huh.
We can do it whether it's practical or not.
Yeah. That's a nice comment. It's one of those interpretations which says this is what the ethics of the reign of God or the kingdom of God is like, and in good Jewish fashion, you have to say is like. That is to say, this isn't a complete list, this isn't a full ethic, but you illustrate the way of life, and one is freed in God's grace to live in that way. There wouldn't be a difference between the two there on that. I would think, though, that Lapide would, from what you described, I haven't read Stendahl, but Lapide and Wink both are pretty sure that Jesus is talking to a specific group of people for whom this is a practical way because the other ways are cut off. It isn't a way of violent revolution. Obviously it isn't. It isn't a way of simple submission. What if you're relatively powerless in the society, but you want to live in a way for the restoration of Israel, which is so much a part of Jesus as the advent of new creation itself? If you want to live that way and you cannot run things, Romans and others are doing that. On the one hand, and you don't want to simply submit as an alternative and passively, on the other hand, or interiorize. No Jew is going to interiorize. This has to happen in history. This has to be a social reality. It can't be a matter of a spiritual interior meaning cut off from the reality of politics and economics. The reign of God covers everything. Then what do you do? What way is open to you? And Lapide interprets it, and Wink interprets it, as for that group in that setting. But it also illustrates what the reign of God, because Jesus is so focused in there. The way of Jesus is the way of God, or the way of God it becomes embodied in the way of Jesus. So it is an ethics of the kingdom. It's what it's like to live by the kingdom.
For me, that really connects with liberation theology.
Yeah.
What are those people we've been talking about? Wandering up in the hills. Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? Are they going to come down in the front square and say, we challenge you to get it done?
Yeah.
So they're trying to do just that.
Yeah. And what they do is something like Jesus. They form a community, an alternative community. And they have to find other ways of doing it. Well, that's his... That's his way of looking at this. I was going to find, I don't know if I can bring it to, locate it immediately. But I'm glad you brought that up, not just because of comparison of practical or impractical. In a way, Stendahl is saying, it is a way that can be lived. And that's what Lapide means as well. But the other nice thing there from that comment is that focus is on kingdom or reign of God and what God is doing here. And the look at Jesus then is in relationship to that. Whereas Christians have tended to look at Jesus rather than God and reign of God. It's a different matter. And part of that, I think, is because in the Hellenistic, in the Hellenic, in the Greek, in the Roman culture, and where Christianity made its impact, when you had to translate into those terms, there isn't a comparable term, there isn't a comparable sense for the kingdom of God. It doesn't come in the way it did for Judaism. You don't have that notion that history is moving towards some goal which will be realized in history by the movement of, by a certain kind of movement. That's just not how they thought of fulfillment.
Where does the phrase the God of history come? You know, that the Old Testament God and the New could be God of history, a God who works through history.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about the origin of the phrase, but it's frequently used to characterize both Jewish and Christian claims that it is in history that, yes, and that...
So God is becoming.
And that history has, this is the location, not on some other plane, somewhere outside of history or something only interior to people, but in historical events. All the both Old and New Testament great religious events and events which have religious meaning are public. The gospel, by definition, is a public announcement, news to be shared. Redemption, Exodus is a public event. It's the freeing of slaves. That's where our word redemption comes from. It's a buying, it means the buying of slaves, the freedom of slaves.
But isn't that relatively recent, at least among Christians? Well,
it's a rediscovery of something that's been there all the while. Now, we individualize faith and we spiritualize it, and both those two things tend to take its focus away from its public character. Golgotha is a public place. Jesus' ministry is all in the open air, as far as that goes, the healing, the teaching, the things that Jews wrestled with as to where the presence and power of God were all public events, whether it's the becoming a state or the Exodus or the exile in Babylon. These are all things that happened in time and place. It's always been there. I mean, the confessions say, suffered under Pontius Pilate. That's a particular time. That's a particular place. It's not some suffering that happens above history, and salvation isn't something that happens on some other plane than history. But when you emphasize Jesus the Jew, you emphasize that basic and originating claim and theme. Yeah.
In the book of Hebrews, I shouldn't even interject that right now. That's a Jewish book, isn't it?
Well, it's
basically it's a.
You have the ethos of high priestly ethos, ethos of sacrifice there. Yeah, that's true, and. Seeing Jesus in that line of being a high priest and sacrifice both. Yeah. Although you get the same thing. The New Testament is fantastically diverse in terms of the thought worlds in which things live. I mean, the letter to the Hebrews is vastly different from the Gospel of Mark, which is very different from John. The language worlds, the thought worlds are very diverse, but you have the same pattern there, of this one who was humbled and yet lived the way of God and was delivered up. And then all kinds of claims of what that means, the titles for Jesus, Son of God, Son of Man, Christ, etc., become ways of understanding the power of this presence in the Jesus movement, making sense of it, saying what happened to us in our experience. Here and continues to happen. Yeah.
Historically, where were the prime movement toward the individualization of the Christian message or the privatization of that message. Where did those come from?
Well, it's in the West, in Europe, in the North Atlantic world, there is an increasing attention, an increasing cultural movements of individualism. So that's part of it. The Enlightenment has as its image of humanity, the Age of Reason, we're talking 17th century and so on, the kind that show up in the Constitution of the United States. The Age of the Enlightenment focuses on individual autonomy and conceives of the individual as the primary unit of human reality, if you want to put it that way. Anglo-American social and political thought is contractual in character. Individuals make agreements with one another, and that's how society originates. So that individualism is from the 17th century. It has predecessors, some of which are biblical. There are strong individuals, prophets, etc. Some of which is the Reformation, which wants to get away from organic notion in society and church, and wants to say that individuals can stand before God and read the Bible, etc. So there are lots of currents, but it's from the Enlightenment on down. And then in our tradition, in Lutheran tradition, you get an interiorizing of Christian faith out of pietism that says the relationship that counts is the relationship between self and God, and it really speaks to the interior of my life. Now, both the individualism and the interiorizing of faith have some connection with biblical religion, but it loses the historical and the communitarian dimensions of it. And when you rediscover Jesus the Jew, you recover those, as you do if you just stay with the Hebrew Bible a lot. It doesn't mean there isn't interiority in that faith. There is. Read the Psalms. But it isn't, again, it's the public character and the historical character of this. I think we better finish, and I didn't want to do so without saying something about the last part of the title for today, namely not just Jesus the Jew, but New Creation, sort of. I wanted to say what I mean by sort of. When you read Jesus and the Jesus movement this way, you find that you demolish one of the dualisms that came later. It's not just public and private and individual and society. It's spiritual and material. That's not a distinction that is biblical, and it's not a distinction for Jesus. Jesus feeds the 5,000 as well as nurtures addresses their spiritual hunger. Body and soul belong together. The spiritual and the material both belong to the reign of God. And for Jews, the final harmony of all things happens in history, bringing history as we know it to an end, but it still is real in society. When Jesus says the kingdom of God is in the midst of you, so many Christians have in later years read that, inside you. It means among you. It's a plural. God's great struggle is to see the end of evil in society and in history. And Jesus' way is an effort to live God's way. Lapid's way of saying that is to say it's a way of de-hostilizing love as a way of life. While we were yet sinners, while we were yet the enemies of God, God reconciled us to God. Jesus' way is a way extending love to enemy and de-hostilizing. It's just a reflection of that. So what about new creation, sort of? Christians say, when we say redemption is accomplished, you run into problems when you talk with Jews, if you make that a very triumphalist statement. Or if we say there is in Jesus a whole new world, or creation is fulfilled. And then you look around you, and what do you see? a world of violence that continues. That doesn't mean this is not a valid claim, but you have to mean something different by say redemption is accomplished. Because it can't be, if you read Jesus as a Jew, internal only. You can't say, I'm whole inside. There, that's what it means. That's not enough of what creation means for Jews and for Christians. You can't say it's for individuals only and not the social conditions of life. You can't say redemption is on another plane than history. It's spiritual, and that's removed from our day-to-day lives. And you cannot say it means there is a historical evolution of progress, sure progress in history. That was held to in the 19th century until World War I had demolished that notion.